Okay.
Yep.
I want to welcome you to another conversation around Play the New Game. And so for those of you who would like to participate in the conversation, feel free to leave your phone unmuted. While we're in this mode, though, if you have any background noise, please do mute your phone. All you have to do is hit the number 6, no star or pound, and that'll give us a clear line. For the next half hour, 40 minutes or so, I want to talk about and introduce you to, if you have not already been introduced to, and if you have been introduced to this conversation before, or you've been with us on previous values conversations, or if you're one of our values coaches, you know, please feel free to chime in here. If you've never heard this conversation before, and this is the first time that you're listening to a conversation around the topic of values, feel free to jot down questions that come to mind or ask specific questions, because what we're going to do is we're going to open up a dialogue and a conversation today that I've actually been having for 17 years. And if you were with us on our March 19th call, we broached the subject of values. Actually, we went into it pretty deeply. Initially, we talked about it from the perspective of values, spiritual living, conscious business, and that elusive thing that we seem to be searching for called peace. And I shared quite a bit of the some of the initial conversation. I shared Dr. Robert Hartman's words, and today I want to really go a little bit deeper, but I want to talk about the application of values in business, because the application of values in business is staggering in terms of its potential for business transformation on all three levels, and we're going to talk about what those three levels are. So today we're going to focus predominantly on values in business, and we'll take the conversation from two perspectives. One perspective is you, yourself, the inner game, if we can call it that, and how your personal, practical, and ideal values affect the way that you perform, the way that you set your goals, the way that you establish the roles that are important to you. And then I want to talk about the outer game, which is how do your skills, your talents, your abilities, do they really get utilized in the highest and best way? And if not, how can you begin to utilize this model of values in a way where you not only can bring more of who you are to the game, but you can also interact more effectively with your teams? And we all have teams. We have our personal team of people that we work with. We have our business teams of people. If we do consulting or coaching, we work with other people's or other companies' teams. So whatever kind of work you do, whether you're self-employed and you're consulting to or being hired by other people, or you're employed and you're working for a company, you still have to work within teams, all right? And it's certainly, if you're one of those people who is rare and does not work in a team, you're kind of isolated or you're kind of aloof or secluded or you're more into the work itself, the technical aspect of the work, then I would suggest that this is even as valuable for you, because it may be that your pathway to playing a better game or elevating your game is to begin to extend your team. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. So I want to spend the first 10 minutes or so just giving you a little bit of a foundation so that we can talk about and answer your questions, and certainly I welcome and invite your questions. The model that we're going to be talking about here is a model that comes from the science of axiology. Axiology is a dictionary word. I've been both student and teacher of it for 17 years now. I've spent over 10,000 hours in this journey. I've personally worked with over 2,500 people. I've probably shared the distinctions with at least 20,000 more by way of webinars, seminars, radio shows, public seminars, private seminars, things like that. And what I will tell you, and I've been through the process myself now in an ongoing way for 17 years. The value of this personally is really beyond measure. It's immense. The value of it from a business perspective can be very significant. In some cases, it can be transformative. Now, we alluded to a single distinction last time, which I frame under the title, Love, Serve, and Obey. New rules for the new game of business, money, and life. And essentially, you could take that model of love, serve, and obey, and you can apply it to any aspect of life you want. We began last week to integrate it and apply it to the business world. And so if you haven't listened to that March 19th conversation, you can go to the blog at playthenewgame.com, go into the calendar, hit March 19th, that blog will come up. All right, and I believe or the March 20th, you'll see a link to download that conversation. I feel it was one of the most important conversations that we've had in years. And I would urge you to share it with colleagues, with friends, with family, with anybody who's really open and receptive and ready to hear it. Today's conversation is going to be much more on a practical note. In addition to the people part of this, there's a huge practical value to people knowing not only what they value, but the distinctions of axiology. We've got somebody coughing in the background. Would you just be kind enough to hit number 6 on your keypad and pedal? Thank you. The practical application here is significant from the point of view if you consider your contribution to your company and your reward and payoff for the contribution that you make. If you consider that practical, then this whole week of conversations will be important to you. And I really want to invite you to not just listen as a theoretical exercise, but to listen from a pragmatic way to say, you know, in addition to how I can use this to enhance my life personally and maybe the people around me, what are the practical applications that I might be able to apply this to getting paid more of what I feel I'm worth, charging more than maybe what I charge for today, establishing another revenue source by either coming up with another service or another skill that maybe I'm not revealing to my clients or the people that I serve, or by partnering with us and actually utilizing this values coaching model in a way that it adds value and reward and income to you, all right, as well as your customers. So think of it as we go forward in that context. So 5 minutes of foundation around the model love, serve, and obey. What we talked about last week, and now let me solidify, this values model is very different than any other model that's out there. In fact, it's unique in that it's the only model of values that has both scientific and mathematic foundations to it. And it has been scientifically and mathematically developed. And as we talked about and I have talked about for years, the gentleman who was the pioneer here that enables us to actually measure our values was nominated for a Nobel Prize in 1973. And unfortunately, he passed away that year. And his work kind of went underground a little bit until our partner, Wayne Carpenter, who was one of Dr. Hartman's last remaining doctoral students, was able to actually provide the software and convert all of the formulas into a software package. And now, after all these years, in 15 minutes, with the accuracy of a thermometer measuring your body temperature, a ruler measuring an inch, or a scale measuring a pound, we can give you a picture of how you think and how you value. And it's really quite an astounding thing to be able to measure. And what's amazing about it is not only its accuracy, but that value as a measure is not static. It's constantly changing. And it's changing because it's based on a three-dimensional model. And so when we look at value and we make a distinction between value and values, we talk about a three-dimensional model of value. And I'm going to keep it very simple for today, but I'm going to give you some resources that you'll be able to learn more, find out more. And we've got just a whole library of very, very powerful audio, plenty of case studies. We have a whole lot of supporting material. But from a practical perspective, all you really need to know is that first we can measure how you think and how you value. We can measure it in those three dimensions being the feeling dimension, the doing dimension, and the thinking dimension. We can then take that matrix, that value profile, if you will, which is a moment in time. It's like taking a blood test today. All right, it will be different in 6 months. It could be different in 6 weeks. And it certainly more than likely will be different in a year. So it's not a static measure. It's an evolving measure. And what it enables us to do is then take the profile and project that profile onto more than 100 different talents, skills, and abilities in dozens and dozens and dozens of categories, all right? So let me give you a even if you're not near a computer, you can write this down. You can go back and reference this. So I'm going to give you a sample. I'm going to use our sales report because it's an easier report to kind of see, and it has a lot of really good stuff on it. And so if you go to thenewgame.com/sales.pdf, thenewgame.com/sales.pdf, and what should come up is a picture or a PDF file of something called the sales assessment. Now, we're not going to go through this, all right, but you can look at this as one of the three dozen or so different kinds of output that we can get from one 15-minute survey. And so this is an assessment that we can measure. If you go to if you're online, you can go to page 3, and you'll see on page 3 there are 9 categories that we measure. We measure things like empathy, practical ability, handling rejection. We can measure your stress. We can measure fear. That's in a different report. We can measure what motivates you. Imagine the value if you're on a team or if you play with a team, which, by the way, we also have profiles reports for athletes, all right? But imagine if you play on a team, which all of us do in some way, or we're part of a team, and you knew in 15 minutes exactly what motivated somebody. And just to show you the depth of the kind of information we can get, and again, if you're not on a computer, you can always go to this at some point afterwards. If you were to go to page 12 on this sales report, you're going to see 6 different motivators: service, money, status, personal development, mission, and belonging. We measure all 6 of those. Now, not only do we measure which of those motivate you more, but we can measure in what order are you motivated and what intensity are you motivated, okay? So in this sales sample, with a one-page graph, which then has much more detail behind it, we could tell this person is motivated first by service, second by mission, and third by a sense of belonging. Now, you could work with somebody for 10 years, and you might not ever know that person well enough or care to know or get deeply enough involved in that person's life to actually know what motivates them. How important is it in any team for anybody playing on the team not only to know what motivates their teammates, but imagine to know what demotivates their teammates? And in some cases, it's astounding but true. If you look at this sample, you'll notice the one thing that is least motivating for this person is C, or status or recognition. So imagine if you are trying to motivate somebody like this person with using status and recognition and maybe personal development, and yet they're motivated most by service and they're motivated next by mission. Or imagine if you're trying to motivate this person with money and this person seems to be saying all the right things and nodding their head, but, you know, deep down inside, service is what really gets them up in the morning. Now, you could take this one page of this report, literally. You could take one page of being able to demonstrate a person's value in the area of motivation, and you could literally transform the organization or any team that you play with or play for simply by being able to know what motivates a person, what demotivates a person, in what order are they and intensity are they motivated. So now think about the application for something like this in hiring, in selection, in promotion, in rolling out a new product. I find it truly and utterly astounding that businesses, from small home-based businesses, people starting their own home-based business, all the way up to the largest mega corporations, Fortune 500 here in the U.S., and international mega corporations, and they're sitting on an enormous pool of talent. There's probably no greater asset, untapped asset inside of a company than human beings. And yet, companies spend so little to really understand what makes us tick. And when you really consider that, just take yourself as an example, when you consider how much more you have to contribute to your audience, to the people that you serve, or if you consider how much more potentially your company can get out of you if they knew how to motivate you, if they understood what you valued, if they understood your strengths and your abilities, if they understood what your blind spots were, all right? And so this is just one small example of how knowing more about human assets, the most valuable, undertapped, and probably at the same time in some companies exploited assets, it could transform not only the way a company does business in the way it does business outside, but it would transform the way it views its people. And even if the company did it just purely from a mercenary perspective, you know, they were just looking to get a better return on their human capital, if you want to call human beings capital, because in the extrinsic world, they are capital. They're assets. They're performing and producing assets. Then it would behoove a company to know as much about a person as you possibly can in the shortest amount of time possible. That's, along with a whole host of other things, what drew me initially to axiology, both as a philosophy, which I aligned with, that to love is the highest value, to love yourself and to love other people, that's an intrinsic value. Intrinsic value is the highest value. The reason it's the highest value is because it cannot be measured. It's infinitely valuable. And when you have something that has infinite value that cannot be measured, in the model of axiology, that's called an intrinsic value, or that's something that is valued intrinsically. That's the highest level of value. The next level of value is to serve. If love is the highest level, to serve is the next highest level. And that means not only to serve other people, but to serve yourself. And one of the interesting things that I've seen, observed about myself and a whole host of other people, probably about 70% of the people that we work with, or that I've actually even profiled over the past almost 20 years now, is that we have a tendency, 70% of us, to actually serve and treat other people better than we do ourselves. And so you want to look at not just how you serve in the world outside of you as the measure of your level of serving, but how well are you serving yourself? I have a real challenge in serving myself as well as I serve others. 70%, 75% of us are afflicted with that challenge. All right? And from a values perspective, most of us who are afflicted with that particular values challenge, all right, we will tend to always do better for and give more to someone else than we will to ourselves. Now, I'm not here to judge any of this as good, bad, right, wrong, you shouldn't do it, you should do it. I'm reporting the distinctions. And if they fit for you, they'll resonate with you, and you certainly will be able to see not only the consequences and implications of us continuing to do business kind of in the blind, in the dark, not knowing what our values are, but not measuring our value, or you'll get that there is nothing probably more important that you can do than to know with quick certainty or high degree of certainty what talents you're not using, what talents you could be using, and what areas you may be over-attending to that are not your best strengths. Many of us are spending a lot of our time doing things that are not our best strengths because we think we have to, or because we've got something locked into our head about what we should do or what we ought to do. Many of us who work for companies or work with companies, we are close to what we have to contribute because the mantra for most companies and the MO of most companies is that they fit the person to the job. They squeeze the person and they shrink the person to fit the job description or the tasks of the job or even the outcomes of the job. That's at least a step up. But you're still shrinking the person to a conceptual description of a set of tasks, as opposed to saying, maybe we should expand the job description to accommodate for this vast, untapped wellspring of potential contribution from this human being that we have sitting here, and not just treat them like a widget or like an assembly line person. You know, the industrial age mindset of a person is not a person is just a cog in the wheel. And what's great about this shift in thinking, what's liberating about this shift in the way that you see the game, is now you're not constrained and you're not limited by somebody else's job description, words, label, perception, concept of your work. Most of us have so much more to give. Most of us have so much more to contribute. And probably most of us have a lot more to be rewarded and harvest from that contribution. But we're kind of blind to our own blind spots. We're not sure of what we're missing, okay? And so that second level, where you serve yourself and you serve others. That's the practical level. Now, anything that's real, concrete, measurable, practical, is what we call an extrinsic value. And that level of value is all about producing results. It's about outcomes. It's about concrete thinking, all right? It's also about performing a role or roles that you're comfortable with. And so in my email about this program today, I talked about role frustration. I talked about soul frustration. If you're in front of the computer, if you're not, you can catch up when you are. Then the page before, page 11, before the sources of motivation, on this particular value profile report, is sources of stress. It's stress factors. Okay? Now, I want to talk just for a minute about this because this leads into the kind of the wrap-up of this at least initial conversation, and I want to open this up to your questions and dialogue a little bit more because this is going to be an ongoing conversation. This is not something that we just say, hey, this is it, here it is, and then move on the next day. This is going to be a common thread through everything we do because no matter what you want to talk about, no matter what you do every day, no matter what choices you make, the decisions you make, all the challenges you face, everything we do has a connection to one or more of these three dimensions. And every choice, every decision, every business choice, every business decision, in some cases, is actually affecting all three dimensions, okay? And so how do you choose to love or serve when your company tells you to obey the rules? Very big challenge, huge challenge in corporate America. And it's such an endemic challenge, it's not even conscious. It's kind of transparent. People don't even know it's there, okay? So they're walking around obeying, not realizing that obey is the lowest level of the value hierarchy, that to obey your company's policy, to obey your company's rules, to obey the authority because the authority tells you to obey, is not the highest and best way to relate to customers. It's the lowest way. And you can justify it because you can say that the company has rules. I found it pretty astounding that I went into Whole Foods, which we have out here. I imagine maybe you probably know it. Maybe you have one. It's like a not totally organic, but it's a Whole Foods market. And I was getting a something to go, and I asked the gal if she could mix two different kinds of vegetables with it. And she says, no, it only comes with one. And I said, would you do me a favor then? Could you just put half the amount of each vegetable so that you know, I'll take the same amount, but just, she says, no, I can't do that. I don't know if I can do that. And I said, why can't you do that? And she said, well, because of the rules. I said, so what's the rule? She said, the rule is you get one vegetable. I said, okay, fine. So what if I only want half the vegetable? She said, well, I guess then I could give you half of something else. I said, okay. I said, Whole Foods, of all places, I would find it astounding. She was afraid she was going to get in trouble. Like I was going to go to the front checkout and say, hey, guess what she did? She gave me half and half instead of one vegetable. Now, I guarantee each and every one of us has had this kind of an experience before. She was willing, at least. I said, you know what? I promise you, I won't say anything if you don't, and I'll even praise you for serving the customer, because after all, isn't serving the customer more important than following the rule? And her answer was, well, I don't know. In other words, here in a store, in a company that prides itself on serving the customer, she was so locked into the rule. She was actually fearful for her job, that she might lose her job or be reprimanded if she gave me the same amount of food, but just half of one vegetable, half another vegetable. Now, that's a pretty simple example, but I'll tell you what. You could take that example, and you could extrapolate it to almost daily experience of life. Somewhere today, I promise you, you had an encounter with a business or a company that was so systemic in forcing and enforcing their people to obey the rules that they didn't even realize they were not serving the customer. Forget about loving the customer or having empathy or compassion for the customer. They won't ever get that high on the totem pole if they can't get from obey to serve. And why is that? Because companies prefer to hide behind their system, to hide behind their rules, to hide behind their protocol, to hide behind their policy. And now, all of a sudden, what you're seeing as part of this transformation to the new game, companies that are getting it, not the companies we've been working with because we've been teaching this for 20 years, but the companies that are getting it are getting that you want to empower people at the point of customer contact, even if it's a maid cleaning a room or a janitor washing the floor, sweeping the floor. You want those people to have the flexibility to elevate their interaction with the customer from the fear-based obey the rules to at least the next higher level, which is a desire to serve a customer. And there are companies now, big companies, that are giving people at the point of customer contact, regardless of what their job description suggests, or regardless of the hierarchy of where they are, you know, as far as their work and their tasks, if they come in contact with the customer, they have the ability to do something to serve the customer. And that alone, right there, if companies get that, and then they teach their people how to do this, and then they recognize that there's a way to measure whether people are good at this or not good at this or naturally good at this or have to learn it, I believe you're beginning to see the potential for not only a greater customer experience, but loyalty, spending more money, turning service into profit. You can never turn obey into profit. I don't know of one, except by total accident, I don't know of one story that anybody has ever told me about a customer interaction or a customer has told me where the context of the conversation was obey the rules, obey the policy, obey the protocol, obey, 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 and that resulted in any kind of profitable interaction. Most of the time it ends in frustration. It ends in both sides, because a lot of times a person on the other end wants to serve, but their rules prevent them from serving. So there's frustration on the service person's part because they can't do the job they were designed to do. There's frustration on the consumer's part because he can't get the service that he looks for. And there's a stalemate, and when that happens, it's like a draw. The tie goes to the consumer every time, meaning the consumer's going to walk away upset, and it's not necessary. And then you don't need to go through a values course just to make this simple distinction in your company. However small or large your company is, if you can today, literally today, teach your people to elevate from obey to serve, that in and of itself will make a huge difference. Now, if you really want to do this the way it can be done, and if you really want to reap the rewards of not only the untapped potential of the people that you have there, but also to retain the people because you understand what motivates them, you understand what stresses them out, you understand what gets them up in the morning All right, you understand what their blind spots are, so you don't give them tasks and responsibilities that go against their natural values and their natural ability or their learned talents and skills. All right, now I want to come back to this this stress page, because this page in and of itself right here, to be able to measure this, this is the seven sources of stress that we can measure with one 15-minute survey. Not only is this so unbelievably powerful in helping people to see the source of what's got them, but stress is a $300 billion a year expense to business, I believe just in America. Worldwide, who knows? Probably $1 trillion. But just in America, we're talking about stress, $300 billion. All the effects of it. In 15 minutes, we can tell you what's causing it. Not the physical stress, but the mental stress. There are three mental stressors I mentioned in the email I sent out. We're going to get more into this as we go further down the road, but I just want to mention them because they're so important. They show up, one or more of these shows up in 90% of the people that we profile, and we have profiled people from every walk of life, from dozens of countries. The validation on this science and this software goes cross-cultural. It's been validated more than most others, and what we see is that 90% of us have either goal frustration, role frustration, or what I call soul frustration. And a good 50 or 60% of us have two of these or more. All right? And the other four sources of stress are tough enough, but they don't show up nearly as consistently as these three. And these three show up consistently as the three most challenging stress factors, particularly these three: soul frustration, role frustration, and goal frustration. And what's astounding to me is that we have the means by which to measure this. Once you identify it and isolate it and understand the distinction of soul frustration, role frustration, and goal frustration, you don't need pills, or you don't need diet, or you don't need, not that those things aren't okay, you know, you're free to do whatever you want. But most of the time, we can help people relieve, if not curtail, if not eliminate, one or more of these three stress factors. And we can do it with a 15-minute software survey, and we can do it in a way that helps people get rid of it permanently. Now, again, this is not like a magic wand, but like every good doctor knows, like every good consultant knows, diagnosis is half the cure. If you know what's ailing you, and you can isolate it, identify it, and really make it come out clearly that this is where the problem is, then you've got half the cure. Misdiagnosis or thinking it's one thing when it's another thing actually leads to a whole other series of events that make the problem worse, not better. And very often what we discover, at least with the people that we work with, who go through a profile and take the 15 minutes to invest and measure this, that we can identify the stress factor, and almost always it's one or more of soul frustration, role frustration, and goal frustration. Soul frustration being you are not in the love dimension of your life. You're not treating yourself intrinsically as well as you could be. Role frustration is the doing part of life. It's the serving part of life. You're not serving in life the way you feel you could be. Or your talent, maybe, or your ability, maybe, or your skills. You don't feel like you're utilizing what you've been given in the way that you could be utilizing it. And you develop role frustration. All right, most of the time, that's the case. Or what shows up as much, if not more, than anything else, and what we've identified, and I personally will call the one biggest values inversion of all, and that is goal frustration. And if I talk to 100 people and ask them, do you have goal frustration? 90 of them will tell me yes. And so we actually have a very simple cure for that. It's a very simple, it's not easy, but it's a very simple cure. And that is, just like love, serve, and obey is the hierarchy of value as applied to the inner game or the outer game of business, in the same way that soul, role, and goal is a hierarchy from highest to lowest. And so if you have goal frustration, most of the time, it's because you don't think you are where you think you ought to be. Let me say it again. Goal frustration is you feel as though you are not where you think you ought to be. It's the distance between where you are and where you think you ought to be at this moment in time. Because where you think you ought to be, or how far ahead of where you are you think you ought to be, is the goal unfulfilled. And that distance is goal frustration. If that distance is small, and you're pretty much where you think you ought to be, and you keep it in proper perspective, you probably have very little goal frustration, either because you're where you ought to be, where you think you ought to be, or you just don't care as much relative to your goal. It's nice, but your value is such that you put more value in role and soul. On the other hand, if you put more of your time and energy and value in goal, which our self-help industry tells you you're supposed to, and that distance between where you are and where you think you ought to be grows larger and larger and larger, that distance represents the depth of goal frustration. And what I'm seeing, and I'm feeling very blessed to be able to help the people that I can see goal frustration has got a grip on them, is that a good 70-80% of us, because we're such a goal-driven society, culture, and this is now global, it's not just in the U.S., that we're so wrapped in this goal frustration that it's spilling over into role frustration and soul frustration, because the bottom line is you have 24 hours in a day, less sleeping time. In your waking hours, if you're paying so much attention to your goal and you don't have enough time left over to pay attention to your role or your soul, not only will you have goal frustration, but you'll also find that you'll probably have some role frustration and soul frustration too. And so how do you relieve yourself of this? And I'm going to give you the answer because it's that important. If I could get this message out to every person on the planet who is afflicted with this, and I'm afflicted with all three of them, okay? So I could be talking to myself as well as anybody else, and it just goes to show you, these are not easy to overcome. I've been at it 17 years, and I'm still, you know, I'm still trying to let go. So it's not an easy thing to do, but you can do it in a moment, and you can make progress with it every day. Here's the prescription, is instead of setting your goals first and then adjusting your role to achieve the goal, no matter what the role might be, even if it's something you dislike or don't want to do, and then sacrificing your soul because you don't have any time left over, reverse the process. At least from the perspective of serve and obey being the goal, serve being the role, Set your role in life or your roles in life first. Identify what you're really good at. Identify what you like to do, where your talents and your skills would offer you a good combination, if not the best combination, of a livelihood that you can enjoy and a living that you can make. And then set the goal within the context of the role. Now, if you really want to make this thing work for you, if you really want to have the love, serve, and obey model maximize, then nurture your soul first. Pay more attention to who you are as a person than what you do and then where you're going, in that order. Take the time. I find it kind of funny that we've come to a point in our culture where we actually have to schedule private time. I mean, think about that. It's insane, but it's true. You have to schedule personal time or private time or, you know, time to for yourself. You know, let me see if it's in my schedule. Oops, sorry, I don't have any time for myself. I'm too busy, you know, serving others. So if you want to take it just one step and get rid of the, or at least have a shot to get rid of the goal frustration, I mean, there's more to this, but this is really the prescription. Then decide your roles before you set your goals. And I'm not the only one who said it. Dr. Hartman talked about it. He said that we are very, very good at knowing things in the world, and we're very good at systemically abusing ourselves and others. And he used the term systemic abuse to talk about how paying too much attention to the systemic dimension, the concepts, the ideas, the missions, the goals, the visions, the dreams, the ideology, all that conceptual stuff, that we can become a slave to our concepts, to our beliefs. An interesting distinction he made, and you should really embrace this because it's a critical distinction that helps you to elevate beyond the systemic realm, is that your values are really just one dimension of your value. That your values, what you believe, what you think, your ideologies, your notions, your expectations, those things, if somebody said make a list of your values, any of those things that are conceptual would fall into the dimension of obey. And so when you recognize that your goal is actually less valuable than your role, because your role is what you do with the precious moments and minutes of your life, whether or not you get to the goal, and you start to shift your order of priority and hierarchy from, you know, goal to role, then to soul, and instead you come from soul to role to goal, then whether or not you achieve the goal is not the highest measure of success in life. That's part of success, but it's not success. It's not all of success, okay? And so the simple prescription is to, when you look at your setting your goal list, there's nothing wrong with having goals, but I would suggest you set your role list. Like, what are all the roles you play? And then, especially with regard to business, and this is where this comes full circle to why it's so critical for businesses to begin to think about utilizing this model, the value profile tool that we use within the model, is because if you can be sensitive to the value that people bring to your company, and you understand that their lives are not devoted to their work, and yet their work is a critical and important part of their lives, and you can give them a place to work where their values are fulfilled, their intrinsic values are fulfilled, their extrinsic values, their love values, their serve values, and that they will then obey whatever policies and procedures you set in place, because they will recognize that the place that you've provided for them to come and work every day values the higher values of love and serve above obey. And people have a funny tendency to obey voluntarily, to work within the system, and actually not let the system wind up becoming the master. And all too often, and we're going to talk more about this on Thursday when we talk about values in you, and then we talk a little bit about values in politics as well, is that we've come to believe that we are here to serve the system. And that's not the case. The system is designed to serve the humans. And whenever a system breaks down and stops serving the human, then from a values perspective, you fix the system. You don't fix the human. And we all too often spend our time trying to fix the human when, for example, on the personal side, if we have goal frustration and we're not accomplishing our goals as we think we ought to, rather than change the goal, we figure there's something wrong with the human. And so we try to go to work on fixing the human, and then we get frustrated because we don't feel as though we're up to the task. And then we diminish our intrinsic value as a result. And unfortunately, a lot of the self-help, the personal development field actually exacerbates the problem, because their mantra is, you know, the goal is the measure of success. But that's an inverted value model. And even though it's been accepted as true, or it's been accepted as right, doesn't make it good. And so what you have here in terms of not only a proven science, mathematical, put all that aside, what you have here is a common sense, feels right intuitively, three-dimensional model of how to operate in the world outside of you, and also how to apply that to your own self, and whether or not you ever decide to do a value profile, whether or not you decide to measure your values, whether or not you even go further down the pike, and if this is the end of your exposure to this, then at the very least, you'll be able to take this model, what we talked about today, and now be conscious when you're making decisions and you're making choices, when you're feeling stressed a little bit, you'll have a place to go to try to at least find out, is it one of these three? Is it soul frustration? Is it role frustration? Is it goal frustration? And if it is, then, well, I can reverse the order. I can put more time and attention on the higher values. Now, that's not to say that if you want to be high achieving and if you want to go after your goals, that doesn't automatically mean that you're going to have soul or role frustration. They're not mutually exclusive. So if you have one or if you don't have one, it doesn't mean that you have another. All right, so don't feel as though if you are very goal-oriented that we're saying that that's not a good thing. We're just saying that goal orientation in the context of a good role, something that really gives you fulfillment, not just helps you achieve the goal, that's going to be a much more fulfilling experience than if you just go after goal, 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 and you have to sacrifice, you know, your role. I don't buy into the old mantra that says, you know, successful people do what unsuccessful people won't do. All right, that mantra, in my estimation, is actually a bit of a perversion of values, because it says that to be successful, you might have to do things that are distasteful or uncomfortable or actually goes against what your role, your best roles in life could be. And that's a twisted definition of success, at least in terms of from a hierarchy of values. So if you can just take what we've talked about here and apply it not only to your personal life but to your business, and if you want to go deeper to recognize that not only could you measure your own values using this value profile, but you could also measure all of the values of the people that you work with, the people on your team, the people that you coach. Wednesday, I'm going to be interviewed by the CEO of Coachville. I'm going to talk about assessments and how to use assessments. And we don't really call the profile an assessment because it too narrowly defines it. But there are assessments that we can run from the value profile. But we can also run screens for hiring people. We can run development profiles for people who are already in a field. We can run project management. There are a number of different ways we can use this tool in business and for you personally. And so before I open it up to questions and comments and any feedback that you want to give, there's a couple of places you can go where you can actually try the profile. We have a special on the how you can get into the game and get a taste of it without having to commit to a lot of money. And that would be at thenewgame.com/clarity101. thenewgame.com/clarity101. And then there's another site it's an older site we're going to be updating soon, and you can find out a lot more. You can read special reports, you can see samples, you can read the history, there's an ebook there. You can go to valueprofiles.com, valueprofiles.com. And you'll also see a way there that we can work with you where you can actually become a reseller. It's called the Profiler Training, and you can read more about that as well. So in summary, I would say that as a start to the conversation about values in business, that there's huge upside potential in being able to release the untapped skill, talent, and ability of every single person you work with, whether they're on your team, whether they're on your clients' teams, from a business perspective. And I would also say that not only is it going to be more effective in releasing potential, but teams tend to function better when the people on the team know both the strengths and the limitations of the people they're playing with. And just like in baseball, you need a first baseman, a second baseman. You don't go out with three pitchers and two right fielders. Most teams will also work better when the complementary skills of the people on the team are working together as opposed to redundantly. And so there's all kinds of potential ways that values can play a role in enhancing a business's profitability, performance, and productivity. And so if you're interested, you can participate in these conversations. If you want to run a value profile for yourself, you can go to thenewgame.com/clarity101. And that's an introductory profile offer. And then, of course, if you want to talk further about opportunities to bring this into your company or ways in which we can work with your company, then you can either email Mitch@thenewgame.com or you can call our offices directly, and you can get that information off of our website at thenewgame.com. Okay, so for those of you who are still with us, I will now open this up to any kind of conversation, feedback, questions you might have.
Mitch, it's Peter.
Yes, Peter.
First of all, on the goal frustration side, I've got a coaching model that I've developed over the last, it's gone on for 28 years now, and we start with the purpose. So the prioritization that you were talking about, I completely agree with that you get the soul before the role, before the goal. And inadvertently, I've done that, but in a different sense. We get someone to establish their purpose in life first. We talk them through that. What is their purpose? Then we get into the value side, what values underpin that purpose. So in other words, this is all about the soul. Then we get into the roles. We ask them to get, for them to get the right balance in their life, what are the four major roles that they're playing at the moment or would like to play in the next 3 years? And for each one of those roles, once they've been identified, we create a 3-year vision. what do they want to be, do, or have within that role over the course of the next 3 years, and then we set the goals. So if you like, the prioritization is purpose, values, roles, vision, and then goals. And another point on the goal frustration side that I've found to be pretty typical of top achievers, that the main reason why they get frustrated in not achieving the goals they set is because their conscious goals do not align with their subconscious beliefs. And because of that, in most cases, they're not aware that this is, you know, they're embarking on these self-sabotaging behavioral patterns and they don't know why. And if you can find out, and we use applied kinesiology, and we establish what the subconscious beliefs are, and sometimes it's quite amazing to see the look on their faces when they discover their reactions to this, and that you've uncovered a belief that is obviously hindering their progress. So that's what we do on the goal frustration side. And just a quick point on the previous one about the rules, getting back to the obeying the rules and the love and the serve. Do you not think, you know, for a company like, say, McDonald's, who would insist on every one of their staff members obeying the rules to the letter, any deviation, they would be out, because they want the client to experience the same degree of service, the same taste in their food wherever they go. Now, isn't that because they've set the rules based upon love and service? In other words, if you can place love and loving your customers and serving your customers first, and then build the rules around those, have rules that actually complement the loving and the serving principle, then I think you won't have that discrepancy. That's my contribution.
Well, yeah, there's always a trade-off, and companies, most companies that do that, that set the rules around love and serve, they still empower people to obey the rules and serve the customer in the spirit of love. And it's a rare company indeed that accomplishes that. Now, whether McDonald's is the best example of that, I don't know, or are they an example to some degree. But love and serve are not systemic values. And the only one place I would depart, in just in terms of our terminology, not in terms of the, you know, validation of your approach, but purpose, by its definition, purpose is a systemic value. Purpose is not the highest value of life, and we could get into a very deep philosophical conversation about this, but I don't, you know, I'm not here to prove anything else wrong. I'm just talking about, from the axiological model, purpose, like vision, like mission, like goals, in terms of the hierarchy of values, all fall in the systemic realm of value. That what is your life purpose? You know, my feeling is, and this is just a personal feeling, is that there is no magical, mystical life purpose. That it might actually be that we're here for many, many, many purposes. And when I get up in the morning, my purpose could be very different than my purpose tomorrow when I get up in the morning. All right? So just in terms of the placement of purpose, purpose is one of the major sources of goal frustration, because people have been told, and unfortunately they tend to believe it, because the people that are telling them evidently have some bestowed authority, that purpose is the purpose of life, that the purpose of life is purpose, all right? But purpose is different than meaning. Meaning is an intrinsic value. Meaning is giving something value because it has some intrinsic quality to it, whereas purpose is just a concept. And so my experience with people who are frustrated around purpose, part of their frustration around purpose comes from the mistaken notion that there is some magical, mystical purpose that we're each of us uniquely here for. And what happens if you go your whole life and you never find it? What if you live to be 80 years old, and you say, "Geez, I've never found my purpose." Yet the truth.
Yeah, well, you see, that's where we would step in at that stage, because where people are looking for two psychologically in-depth answers to these, you know, magical revelations, we're suggesting that initially our purpose, and we take a leaf out of the Dalai Lama's book here, he's probably done more meditation on this planet than anyone else, and he says our purpose in life is to be happy. So we generally suggest to our coaching clients that maybe your purpose is to be happy, and now when we're looking at the four roles that they're playing in their life, can we define what happiness looks like and feels like and tastes like and smells like in each of those areas, in each of those roles? And that sets us up for the initial, because it's a feeling thing. It's a very much a kinesthetic response. How will I feel when I'm there? So although my goals might be the materialistic and tangible signposts along the road, the purpose is the feeling. That's when I'm going to feel happy or feel fulfilled or feel contented. You know, once we've got the purpose set up that way as a feeling one, then the values have more meaning.
Okay, well...
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. All I'm suggesting to you is that from a values model perspective, that purpose is not a feeling. Purpose is a concept. Now, you can love a purpose, you can love a person, you can love whatever, and that's certainly a feeling. And you can feel good because you feel like you're doing a purpose that matters, all right? But what if you're doing something that you think has no purpose, yet you bring your whole self to it? And so when you bring your whole self to it, the purpose of it is whether you achieve your purpose or you don't achieve your purpose. I think the definitions are different. The distinctions are different. I'm not here to invalidate. I'm only here to just suggest that in this model, purpose is something that you conceptually think about, but it is not an intrinsic feeling. And so for us, in terms of how we apply axiology, in terms of people that are frustrated with their purpose, is we say that essentially, you know, purpose is just an idea, it's a concept. And so if you get up one day and you have no purpose, you can still be happy. You don't need a purpose to be happy. Okay, and that's a huge...
Well, the purpose is to be happy.
Pardon me?
I say the purpose is to be happy.
That could be. I know the Dalai Lama says that, but just like any other authority, that does not necessarily make that so. And you can believe it, you can buy into it. I'm not suggesting it's not something to buy into, but purpose and happiness, they're two different dimensions of value. And you can have one...
You see, I think you touched on something important a little while ago when you said... In fact, I think you made a distinction between purpose and meaning. If you look at the most popular graduate school of business program at the moment, is at Harvard Business, the Graduate Business School, and it's Happiness in Business, and it's run by Professor Tal Ben-Shahar. He's an Israeli professor.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, these are all scientifically validated, and he's basically saying that here are these successful people coming along, they're falling over themselves to get onto this program because they're very successful in business, but they're not happy. And he's teaching them how to be happy in business. And basically, the way that he's doing that is by saying, what you're doing every day must give you meaning. And if there's two things that you can do, and we've done a little exercise on this ourselves. We've adapted his theory, if you like, into a practical exercise, which says you just write down everything that you do. Everything in a typical week, write down all the things you do. There may be 57 things on the list. And then you put two columns next to it. And the one column you head M for meaning and the other P for pleasure. And you just tick the ones that if this is going to give me if this has meaning in my life. And what does meaning represent then? And in his words, it represents that this is leading towards my purpose in life. So if my purpose in life is to be happy, then carrying out this activity is leading me towards that and therefore has meaning in my life. The second column is the pleasure one, that's where your strengths are matching whatever you're doing, and so you're getting daily pleasure out of it because you're engaging your strengths. It's a simple exercise, and yet one that helps these high-flying business people to see that happiness can be an integral part of their business life.
Right, right. Well, without going too deeply or further down the pike here, I could see how that would be a helpful exercise. There's still a very important distinction here, at least from our paradigm and our model, which is happiness is a place you come from. It's not a function of anything you do. And so you can do things that have no meaning. Chop wood, carry water. One of the best books I've ever read, one of the best models of life that I've personally come across, so much so that I teach my son, that it doesn't matter the task that you're doing. What matters is the love that you bring to the task that you're doing. So you say, can a janitor be successful? Can a janitor be more successful than a hard-charging business owner who makes $25 million? Well, in a typical definition of success, you wouldn't even put those two people in the same category. Yet, the hard charger is going to find out how to figure out, how do I be happy making $25 million? And it's possible that the janitor every day brings his soul and his spirit to his work in such a way where he loves what he does and he serves others, even though on a scale of meaning and purpose, you might say that it's not very meaningful or purposeful to mop floors and clean schools, let's say. So,
But it is to him with his values.
Well, it's what it comes down to is it's not a function of what you do that bestows the meaning. It's how you do it. And so you can take a menial task that may seem like it has no meaning, and you can have meaning from it because you bring your whole self to it. And that little distinction, I'm not saying it's different than what you're saying. I don't want to compare the two because then you get into is this better or worse? Whatever works is good as far as I'm concerned. And so if people are happy, they're happy not as a function of what they do. They're happy more as a function of how they do what they do. And whether it fulfills their purpose or not, or whether it fulfills a purpose or not, is another level of value. And so if you look at these three dimensions of value as integrated, we're always operating on all three, and all three are always operating on us, and every experience has an intrinsic, extrinsic, and systemic dimension. But you can also take them apart. And so you can have an intrinsic experience of being happy, which is intrinsic. You don't do happy, and you don't have happy, and you don't go happy. You have to be happy. So whether you're doing something you like or whether you're going somewhere you like, you can actually still be happy. And tomorrow I'm actually going to make a big distinction in values and money between financial independence and financial freedom, which most of us conflate the two together, and yet they're two completely different states of value. One being an economic measure, an extrinsic measure, the other being an intrinsic experience. You can be free without having financial independence. And yet I know dozens, if not hundreds of people who are financially independent and are not free of their money. So very, very slight distinctions. No one way is the right way. Every way is an okay way. And I just wanted to be clear about our distinctions in terms of the model of axiology, because that's the model from which we're measuring these different categories. And so I very much appreciate your contribution and sharing that little exercise, because I think that exercise is very valuable for people and will help them. So,
great. Thanks, Rich.
Thank you very much, Peter. Very spirited conversation. Anybody else want to jump in and share before we end here today? Give me your comments. Was this valuable? Was this helpful? Do you see the potential for something like this in bringing these distinctions to business? Okay. Well, I'll repeat those two websites that you can go to, thenewgame.com/clarity101, and then valueprofiles.com, and at valueprofiles.com, you'll also be able to see if you want to get more involved in working with us and bringing values measurement to your clients. You'll see a program called the Value Profiler Program, and we'll talk more about that as the week goes on as well. So anybody with a
Wayne?
Yes.
Yeah, Wayne. It's Wayne from Clearwater. One quick question on this. Do you see this? I mean, I've noticed in some companies people have silos and they guard their turf, and sometimes they get people in there they don't want. This is kind of a reverse sell, but it would give them a way to guard their turf better to keep the people out of there they don't want. I don't like to say that, but
well,
in some of the companies.
Well, I'm glad you did, because that's a reality of life, isn't it? That people guard their turf and they protect their little fiefdoms. So that is a reality. So, yes, will this do that? If that's the intended result, that's fine. You can use it for that. You can also use it for severing relationships with people. You know, a lot of companies are stuck right now, and they're not sure what to do with people, some of their people. The companies that are downsizing, well, you know, it's the system is weeding people out. But there are a lot of companies right now that really, really need to get more out of people, and if they can't, they need to know that the relationship is not working. So in many cases, running a values assessment or running a value profile can help you to determine if a person is not really suited for your company or not suited for the work, or maybe they're suited for something that you never gave them consideration.
Okay.
Because you have them stuck in a position. So, yeah, you know, for practical purposes, sure. Could you use this to protect your turf even more? Absolutely. And some people will. And that's, you know, that's not for me to judge. Your question is, can you use this for that purpose? And yes, you can. Dr. Hartman made an amazing distinction. And he said his whole work in axiology was to define what is good. How do you define good? And after all of his scientific and mathematical calculations, he came up with a definition of good. And the definition of good is the extent to which something fulfills its purpose. How do you like that, Peter? We're right back to purpose. So can you have a good assassin? Sure. Actually, you can have some very good assassins. Are they moral? No. Morality and good are not necessarily, they don't go together, because you can have a good tyrant. You can have a good torturer. You can have a good sniper. All right? What it means, good, the definition of good in the axiological model is the degree to which something fulfills its purpose. So if you say to somebody, go get me my good shoes, how will they know which shoes you mean? Do you mean your very best dress shoes? Do you mean your most comfortable shoes? Do you mean your sneakers that you kick around in, or maybe your house slippers? Depends on how you define good. So in this case, Wayne, your question is, if the purpose is to further insulate yourself from the crazy masses of people, you know, and you're up on the 15th floor and you got to protect yourself, yes. Can this do that? Yes. Is it the highest and best use of it? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
But can it fulfill that purpose? Absolutely.
Well, I see that a lot in government and in the union places in the Northeast, like Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Cleveland. The way, just when you said that to me, I started thinking, you know, I go in there and I rattle companies, and some of those people want me out of there so fast it's not even funny. And I think they just want to hire people like them that sit in the corner, don't question anything, and, you know, they filter through that. And so this would be something you could sell them to say, here's how you protect your turf. Not that you add any value to the organization, but here's how you protect your turf.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that really speaks to how, well, certainly everything in government, but even in other industries and arenas, how systemic businesses have become. And the real meat of this conversation is not whose method you use, or, you know, whether you use this method or Peter's method or some other method. I mean, there's plenty of ways to get to Rome, you know, as they say. What really matters is, at a very fundamental level, looking at your business organization and say, are we an organization that loves, serves, or obeys? Now, most organizations do some of all three, but not much on the love side, all right? The better organizations, the companies that people want to work for and that people want to buy from, absolutely, whether they're conscious of it or not, are operating at the love and serve dimensions. And to the degree that obey needs, the system needs to be in place to hold it all together, the serving and the loving is what they're after, and this system is designed to facilitate the serving and the loving. If you see an organization, obviously government and all those highly systemic organizations, what you see is an organization that is built upon the model of systemic values, protocol, policies, procedures, pecking order, hierarchy, chain of command, authority. The system overrides the serving, and rarely, if ever, will you even hear the word or, you know, see the word love show up.
It's more like a monopoly.
Yeah, I when you really, if you break it down to the simple and the sublime, and I love the model of three. I was writing a book called The Power of Threes. I never finished it, but I've identified 33 different powers of three, and it's a perfect model, because if you look at everything in life, essentially it's three-dimensional until you get to the fourth dimension, which I'm sure is coming. But that three-dimensional model fits very well, because you can tell collectively, is your organization systemic by nature? Is it serving by nature, extrinsic, meaning pragmatic and getting the job done? Or is it compassionate by nature? And from a personal perspective, you know, if you really want to stand out in the business world, aside from technical skills, which we all have to have technical skills, people pay the most money not to the people with the most systemic technical skills, not to the idea people, but to the people who create an experience that they never forget. And that's the intrinsic dimension of value. And there are companies, and I went to one today, Apple. You walk into Apple, the store, it's an intrinsic experience. The minute you walk in there, you feel like a human being, you know? And they design their system to make you feel like a human being having a great experience, and you can go in there and you can play with all of their stuff. So you can be, you can do, and you can – it's all tied together by a system that's unobtrusive. And when the system breaks down, they don't punish the people, all right? They elevate, they always serve the people above the system. And you can tell when you patronize a company, are they a systemic company? If your company is a highly systemic company, the only way you can know that most of the time is you ask your customers, because it's very hard internally to look at your company from the outside looking in as a customer, because you're not a customer, to know if your company is sourced more in being a systemic company, a service company, or an intrinsically driven, compassionate, empathetic company. And so you can up-level at each interaction. So at every human interaction you have from this point on, if you find that interaction is systemic, you know, it's very conceptual, it's ideological, it's you're getting stuck in who's right and who's wrong and whose system and process is better. If you really want to just blow past that, up-level your conversation to the pragmatic, to the extrinsic, to the service. How can we serve each other better? Forget about who's right and who's wrong, whose system is better, whose system, who, you know, forget the process for a second. Let's talk about how we can serve each other better.
Let me ask you one more quick question. Sure. Is this served over the web, this question thing, or they do it on forums? How does it work?
The profile itself, you do it right on the Internet. It takes you 15 minutes. You rank order two sets of 18 items, and you're done. And then we can run more than 40 different reports, things from project management, sales, customer service, management. We can run a report called personal performance where we can actually measure your fear. We can identify 5 different sources of fear that hold people back. Imagine knowing what that 800-pound gorilla in the room actually is, that it's only a 20-pound weakling called the fear of disappointing others, and you can put your hands on it. So it's a very – and by the way, you can print it out and do it by hand. That's how we did it up until about 5 years ago. But now you can do it all online.
Well, I know a few retired VP, CFO kind of guys from major billion-dollar companies. That's why – and they might like this. That's why
I would suggest, Wayne, is just go through it for yourself. I think Clarity 101 is $99. It's a steal. Mm-hmm. You get a report, and if you want, you can be part of the group, or if you want some private coaching, I can do that as well. But we always tell people the difference between talking about something as a theory and actually experiencing it is the difference between an intrinsic experience of something and the systemic theory of it. And when we apply this to into business, not just in terms of generally speaking, but you actually start to apply the distinctions in business, you're going to find yourself being much more comfortable with asking people for commitment, because what you recognize is that change cannot occur on a systemic conceptual level. That you can talk your purpose all day, all day, all day, but like we said on our prior call, give me an old beat-up shack on the beach rather than the concept of a mansion if I have to get out from the storm. And so you can talk about it theoretically. I always basically tell people the only way you really know what this is to experience it yourself. And that's true, by the way. That's true for everything that you're asking people to commit to. The difference is now you have a very simple three-dimensional model to know whether people are committed to the experience of it, the doing of it, or the concept of it. And it's a fabulous way to actually weed out people. I can do this now because I've been at it for so long, but I can weed out people in 5 minutes just talking to them and seeing where their conversation is. Is there conversation around, the theory, the concept, the process? Is there conversation around, let's do it, let's move on it? Or is there conversation around the experience of it? And based on being alert to those cues, it becomes very easy then to, align with those people in their value dimension where they pay the most amount of attention and help them in that way. So it's a fun thing.
Super. All right.
Thanks, Wayne. I appreciate your question. Okay. Anybody else? Last question or comment? All right. Well, thank you all for joining us. And one more time, we went way over our time, and we'll have to find a way to cut these conversations down to the intended half hour. But thank you once again for joining us, and we'll be back again tomorrow for another conversation around Play the New Game. Have a wonderful day, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.